Mr. Hitchcock, real late. We were talking about your time based at Portsmouth and operating in the English Channel and you know, further up the coast as the land warfare moved on. You were mentioning about getting back on the trot boat.
The trot boat was a huge lumbering hulk of a vessel, some sort of tug, and it took about 2 hours or even more to get round the fleet. So if you came back when the pub shut at 10:30 or 10 o'clock, nonetheless it would take you a long time to get round and get back. You might be getting back well after midnight. And on a wet night in August, it wasn't very pleasant. And I have memories of some pretty horrendous journeys on this vessel, then having to climb up rope ladders with wooden slats to stand on, get up the side. And you can imagine that if you were worse for wear, that was somehow equivalent to being lost at sea if you fell in. And people did fall in. I also remember our ordnance artificer having a desperate argument with a huge Canadian sailor, which wasn't very pleasant. He was about three times his size, and the guy kept coming back for more, and each time he was told to go away. Although he was a chief petty officer and this guy was an ordinary sailor, nonetheless, he wasn't averse to putting one on him.
Did you go ashore much?
I went ashore mainly if I had chance to go and visit my relatives who had by this time had moved near to Chichester. And I have very happy memories of getting to the morning train at Bosham from where they lived outside Chichester, a place called Fishbourne, and coming through into Portsmouth, changing the idyllic English countryside for war. It was a remarkable contrast. I suppose the only people who did that kind of thing were the Battle of Britain pilots, or maybe those from Bomber Command, but it was equivalent. And on one occasion we went, this was quite early on when we were in Portsmouth, we did go do a tour around the Channel Islands with two travel class destroyers, the Athabaskan and the Huron, the Haida. And I believe the Athabaskan was sunk quite early on in the invasion. The objective was to scour the seas around the Channel Islands for any German shipping and possibly even draw the fire of the Channel Island batteries. That was earlier, something which I've omitted to say. From Portsmouth, we were summoned north. People actually welcomed this. We sailed through the Irish Sea to Belfast. We'd had a short sojourn at Belfast when we were being fitted out in the very early days, but now we're back in Belfast as seasoned battlers. And on this occasion I was given leave and went home in late September. Our next mission, using the Americanization, was to close the exit or entrance to the North Channel. We sailed for about a month. One vessel with radar full on, as they were fully working, being the gateway to the Irish Sea. And we sailed back and forth, protecting the entrance. And this we did until well into October. When we came ashore, again in Belfast, had a short leave, and then off we went northwards on our next mission. This was to join a Russian convoy out with one RW 61. The inner ones, the return ones, are RA, I believe. However, that can easily be checked.
Now, what do you remember of that? That was to Kola, wasn't it? Kola.
Yeah, well, we set off with our escort group, having been relieved on the previous mission by HMS Whittaker. We set off to Loch Ewe, sailed northwards with 15th Escort Group, SO Louis, second in command, Narborough. And we formed there a long range escort group. We didn't see much of Loch Ewe, we didn't see much of the convoy. We knew that it was a pretty powerful convoy. We knew that we had cruisers, that we had aircraft carriers, two escort carriers, possibly three. Again, I wasn't particularly concerned with this because, in fact, we saw very little of the convoy. The numbers of ships, the names of the ships, are fully documented, and no need for me to refer to these at this point. We sailed northwards and soon became aware that the weather was not good. We met gale after gale. In fact, it seemed that the gales were our greatest enemy.
What was it like? How bad was it?
The aircraft carriers, when we did see them, or if we did see them, were pitching some 40 feet. The deck would go up by 40 feet at least. The waves were horrendous. It was dark a lot of the time. And when you could see the waves, there were occasions when the aerials were being whipped by the white horses, well, there were more than white horses, by the tips, the curling tips of the waves, rather reminiscent of the famous Japanese painting of wave. That was of a tsunami, and that's what it felt like. You wondered occasionally whether the ship would actually right itself. It did. We had a great deal of confidence in the skipper, who was on the bridge most of this journey.
How did you cope yourself? I mean, you had seasickness.
I was sick. One day I was seasick. Seasickness really begins when you set off. It might even be the thought of it. Though we do hear of people who actually get sick on the pontoons as they join the vessels. They were usually not meant to go to sea at all. Seasickness is a peculiar thing because you start off by feeling hot, headachy, a little feverish, and you begin to retch and take up your breakfast. Later on, you take up what is left of your breakfast, and then again you take up what is left of your breakfast, until eventually there's nothing left at all. And I was seasick on one occasion 25 times in one day, which was, and I still worked, I was even thrown out of my bed. I doubt if you'd be thrown out of a hammock, but you could be thrown out of these bunk beds. So much so that I actually strapped myself in, because when you put your bunk up, which we didn't do very often when we were at sea, you had straps to strap it up, and I used these to strap myself in so I didn't fall out. The seas were unpleasant, and that was the main thing that you had to fight against. We were indoors, so we didn't have outdoor clothing, so we didn't have to face any ice, snow. Actually, on the journey we went on, there was very little snow and
this
ice.
Is late October, isn't it?
Late October. However, we had to work. The locker we sat on shot back and forth as the seas mounted. And so we went northwards as a long-range escort group, keeping the submarines down. We had, obviously, messengers knowing where the U-boats were. The high-frequency direction finding were told by us when a submarine was transmitting. They also had their own means of finding whether submarines were transmitting. And if you could get a triple cross, that was three directions, and you could either decide whether the submarine was inside the triangle of error or outside the triangle. Awful lot outside the triangle of error. There isn't so much inside it. Generally, U-boats transmitting were outside our triangle of error. But we could be directed to find a U-boat in this way. Admiralty was doing this all the time, and signals would often end with U-boat transmitting and giving the bearing and so on. And they would hope that you had also got a bearing on this U-boat, because they didn't transmit for very long. Got a bearing on this U-boat, and you could go and attack. We were essentially an attack group. But our main job was to protect the convoy and keep the U-boats down.
Now, do you remember much of what happened? Was the convoy attacked?
The convoy was not attacked to any extent. But we did know that waiting for us at the Kola Inlet were 18 U-boats, and our job was to keep them under. By this time, the large surface vessels were no longer a menace. By this time, the air bases in the north of Norway had been abandoned, and what is more, being October/November, it was dark most of the time, and so the aircraft couldn't find us so easily. We used ASDIC and radar, but ASDIC in those northern waters, because of the thermals, the different temperatures, the fact that ice was of little value. The convoy sailed north. I remember one of the bearings that came up was that we were north of Bear Island, and this is up by the ice pack, so that we went up to the ice pack and sailed round the island into the Kola Inlet, where we anchored. The Russians were not very friendly to us, but I also remember the acts of generosity by the British towards the Russians.
What happened to the U-boats that were in the Kola Inlet?
The U-boats were kept under by the escorts, but not entirely, because we were not in that area for long. I'm not privy to this, but Jack Richardson, the Tal S, told me that they went ashore, or tried to get ashore, to have a game of football. But obviously something of a plus to have a game of football in the Arctic. They were shot at by the Russians, by ordinary Russian soldiers, whereupon they left hurriedly. However, we didn't stay long. We oiled and stored, and soon were sent along the coast of Russia towards Archangel, where I believed we were to pick up vessels to make up the return convoy. We came back to the Kola Inlet, and it was at this point that we had a battle of sorts with U-boats. Battles with U-boats are not spectacular unless a ship is hit. What happens is simply that you latch on to a U-boat, but because of the problems with ASDIC, this is very difficult, so your objective is to keep them down. You fire depth charges, a pattern of six, and by that process, keep their noses underwater. Unfortunately, we were at action stations having something of a skirmish when Mountsey was hit by what turned out to be a NAT torpedo. This was an acoustic homing torpedo which damaged the stern and killed some 12, I believe, men. I was at action stations at the time, and George Greenhorn was on the RT and received the message that a torpedo had passed between our foxes. Now, a foxer is a paraffine which is streamed behind and makes a noise. They are loosely called noisemakers. And the idea was that you stream two of these, the noise went on, and the homing torpedo, the acoustic homing torpedo, went for one of the paravanes. Then the noise went off, and the torpedo went for the other paravane. And in this way, you hoped that it would run out of steam, or get so confused it wouldn't know what it was doing. And in our case, this may well have happened. But sadly, one of these torpedoes hit Mountsey, one of our sister ships, not far from where we were, and Mountsey came to a halt. It damaged the stern, which would mean rudder, screws, and means of propulsion. And we were directed, being the second SO, to pull alongside Mountsey and take her in tow and get her back into Pollyarno. This was a rather hair-raising enterprise, because here we are up in the Arctic, the odd torpedo floating around, and we having to hope to get a tow on board, which we did with the usual method of throwing a heaving line across, pulling in a small rope, and then pulling in, which was a heaving rope, and then pulling a hawser in. And so we towed, this was fixed, and we started to tow Mountsey back to Pollyarno. Allowing that we were some distance out, and it was still fairly rough, it wasn't all that long before our tow parted. And I believe one of the other vessels, possibly the Inglis, took over our role, and we rather thankfully left Mountsey to Inglis. And then later on, as Inglis got nearer in and out of the rough weather, Mountsey was able to proceed up to Pollyarno under its own steam, rather slowly, rather haltingly. But then I know little about that.
Now, what were you doing during this?
I was mainly at action stations, which meant sitting in the chart room, helping to plot.
On the plot,
the position of U-boats.
And the ship had rejoined the escort group, I presume.
The ship had rejoined the escort group, and after a day or two, perhaps even less than a day or two, we were able to pick up the outgoing convoy, which was RA-61. And this, again, had a different composition of vessels, and this can readily be checked in the archives. Far be it from me to tell you exactly what the inner escort was made of, but we sailed back in gales. By this time, we'd been in gales, we'd lost one ship damaged, and we were then down to five. Sailing back, we began to shed ships in the North Atlantic. It was an uneventful journey back. There were no U-boat scares, to my knowledge, and we only had to face the weather. The ships, Lorimer, Inglis, and I can't remember the other one offhand, we'll come to it in a minute, had to pull in to different ports on the way back, in the Hebrides, the Scottish mainland, until the only vessels still sailing effectively were Louis, the SO, and Narborough. wasn't long before Louis began to experience difficulties with her propulsion, and in order to speed up our return to Belfast, Narborough took Louis in tow. This was coming, now we're coming towards the southern end of the Minches, that is between the Hebrides, the Outer Hebrides and the Inner Hebrides, and when I was off duty, I was able to get up early in the morning when it was light and look at the mountains, the Scottish mountains, passing us by. It was an unforgettable sight. So we sailed towards Belfast. When we got to the entrance to Belfast Lough, we got a nice signal from Louis, cast off, tow, proceed independently, which meant that Louis went first and we went second. By this time, sufficient repairs had been done to whatever damage was causing her to slow down, and she could do about 14 knots. But 14 knots in Belfast Lough soon became 10 knots, and we struggled what appeared to be a whole day before we could get ashore, anxiously looking at the time to see whether the pubs would still be open. And I remember coming to a very wintry November Belfast, pulling alongside when it was piped, Liberty Men ashore, and I and one or two others galloped ashore, deciding that there wasn't much mileage in getting to the pubs. In fact, that it would be better to go to the canteen on Pollock Dock, which we did. And this may seem a tall story, I promptly fell over, partly because it was rather icy, and partly because the key was still. And I didn't trip up, I just simply fell down. So I picked myself up into the canteen, and we were able to have a drink of porter to welcome us back to the hilarious days of Belfast, and they were. We didn't mess about going ashore in Belfast. We had one objective in view, which was to get a good meal and to have many pints of porter.
Guinness, or the equivalent of Guinness.
Porter was a light Guinness. Many years later, when I went back to Belfast, they still brewed porter. They don't brew it now.
So you'd taken to drink a bit by then?
It was impossible to drink when you were at sea. I didn't have to take my tot because I found that it sent me to sleep. Actually, I did illegally draw my tot and sell it to one of the signalmen, who was rather an older bloke and liked to have tots. The reason I didn't have a tot was quite simply that I didn't like drinking it and falling asleep. Equally, I couldn't keep it. There had been a signal in Western Approaches at some stage that tots had to be well watered down, which was called 2-1, because two young sailors, having their 21st birthday, had stored up their tot, drunk it, and had suffered fatal consequences. So we were told quite strictly not to. This was for the other ranks. The petty officers, of course, could have a full, neat tot. They were not watered down. The only thing I did with my tot, if I had it, was to sell it for the price which I would get if I didn't draw it. I gave that up fairly soon and said, oh no, I can't be bothered. I will have my extra threepence a day, which is what a tot was worth.
Now, what's the next? You got back in November 44. What's the next operation you remember?
The time now is a little desultory. In fact, very little seemed to happen. Convoys into the Atlantic, back into Belfast, back into the Channel, when in the spring, the war is coming to an end now, in the spring of 1945, we were escorting coastal convoys again. So really, back to the beginning. And no great events occurred.
What's the next thing you do? You seem to have had a period in
the
next at Devonport.
Yeah, well, we were in Devonport. We were one of the Devonport duty ships, so we were working with Bulldog quite a lot. So we then left the convoy system. We left Louis, said goodbye to Louis, left the 15th Escort Group, and were apportioned to the Devonport station, where we began to do rather interesting things again. The first was to join in the liberation of the Channel Islands. This was immediately prior to end of World War II in Europe. We were still at war with Germany. And Bulldog and Narborough were delegated to escort the liberation convoy to the Channel Islands, to St. Peter Port, which was the main port of the Channel Islands, rather than Guernsey. And we went in rather nice spring weather in the early May of 1945 to Guernsey, escorting the supply ships, the army vessels. They were a hotchpotch, a mishmash of vessels taking troops to occupy the Channel Islands, in our case, Guernsey. We pulled into St. Peter Port, well, we pulled off into the anchorage, and were met by a whole host of welcoming vessels, either looking for handouts or looking to tell their stories. We didn't go ashore. The army vessels went ashore, the odd landing craft, LSD, went ashore, but we didn't. The ships didn't go ashore, the personnel did. And so we came alongside, or these vessels came alongside, and we talked with them. What was it like? Usual blah. And they spun yarns. We didn't believe them. But I have a cutting which was from the local paper at that time. There is one main cutting, but I've got one which was from a letter I wrote home after the war was over, talking about the liberation of the Channel Islands, and of such things that rats were disappeared, cats didn't exist anymore, and that they didn't make a very good stew, so on and so forth. They didn't have much to offer, but they had obviously had quite a hard time. I have never been to Guernsey since, but I must go back one day.
Now, you escorted some German minesweepers back, didn't you?
We picked up a number of German vessels, a motley set of German vessels, 8 in all, a couple of minesweepers, I think, and odds and ends. And these were escorted back by us and Bulldog to, of course, it was the time when all vessels were surrendering, so it wasn't really a question of...
So where were you when VE Day was?
We escorted these ships back to Plymouth. And there was an interesting episode about 2 days or before VE Day, which was surrender in Khorsand Bay, when these ships were surrendered to the British Admiral or his representative who came aboard in Khorsand Bay, and the people in Plymouth felt that the war was now over. They'd had this sight of German ships actually being brought into port, shepherded in by two British warships, and surrendering.